Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, wherever you may find yourselves around the world. Welcome to DeveloPod, and I'm here in the virtual studio with Tanya and James. Welcome both.
Hi, Christian. Hi, James.
Hey. Hi, both of you. Nice to be here.
I'm in snowy Brighton in the south of the UK.
I'm in very snowy Guelph, just outside of Toronto in Ontario, Canada.
Well,
if it starts snowing here in Brazil, then we're all in trouble.
Guelph sounds like a nasty skin condition.
We are known as the world's first veterinarian university.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and so it's often called U of Goo.
So we're here today to talk about the TDAJ, the Teacher Development Academic Journal. And we've just published the second volume. And this volume is on the theme of race and queerness. Now, this dates back, I suppose, to December last year, where we gave a web carnival on the same topic, race and queerness. So many of the speakers have written really interesting articles, and we're going to each review an article for you today to chew them over a little bit and give you our thoughts. So, Tanya, what did you read?
Well, I read the article by Elizabeth Coleman called Why and How Should One Make Classrooms Less Heteronormative? Mm-hmm. And I found it very interesting. I liked how she broke the article down.
Okay. Can I ask you there? In fact, I was just talking to someone today about the word heteronormativity and heteronormative. Can you just explain what that is, first of all?
Sure. Certainly from my limited perspective, I think it's the idea of gender and sexual orientation always falling very strongly within the camp of the heterosexual orientation. Uh-huh. I think Elizabeth does a good job of kind of highlighting how everything is very focused on the man-woman pairing. And from a cultural perspective, it's seen as the pinnacle of relationships. That to have a healthy, normal relationship, it involves a man and a woman. And she even goes so far as to say that that heteronormative idea is almost that being heterosexual is akin to being a full human being. The human experience is whatever is socially constructed or culturally constructed around that male-female bonding in a romantic relationship.
Yeah, I think there's that idea of it's like the default position, right? Mm-hmm. So you have like, what is the default position? And if you look at ELT materials, what you're normally going to see is heterosexual relationships being one of those, right? Mm-hmm. There are other ways that that's embodied as well, you know, sort of male, middle class from a Western country and so on. In terms of relationships, mm-hmm. heteronormativity is undeniably what you're going to see in, well, pretty much all ELT materials, I think.
And interestingly, if I may just say, within the gay world or the LGBT world, there are still people who fall into that heteronormative concept, so that they still subscribe to the idea of two people in a relationship within a marriage or a long-term bond. And that's a very heteronormative way of looking at an LGBT relationship, subscribing to the heteronormative view of the world, what we should be.
Yes, and I think this also incorporates the idea that sex equals gender expression as well, within that heteronormative aspect, which she tries to challenge in this article, that in fact she's saying, hang on a minute, sex doesn't equal gender and it doesn't equal gender expression. It's far more fluid than that.
And how does she relate this to the world of ELT?
Well, she kind of takes us on a bit of a journey by even challenging a concept I think that is quite commonplace. She starts by challenging the idea that 10% of every population in every country approximately is going to fall in the LGBTQ camp. And she's saying, in fact, this is not so much the case, that recent research on Gen Z, who are people between the age of 6 and 26, she's saying that they report as much as 50% not being exclusively heterosexual, and about a third represent as bisexual. So she's saying, first of all, it's far more prevalent, at least from a few studies, than people think, and that she feels there's just been no improvement within the field of ELT materials.
Improvement in what terms?
Improvement of representation, mm-hmm. improvement of expanding diversity, inclusivity. And I think she's expressing a very clear argument towards, like, why should we care about it and what can we actually do about it? I find it a very practical type of article. And I think there's a couple of her main takeaway points in that her main focus is that education is not neutral. So she's saying that because education is always within a sociocultural context, if it's always supporting that heteronormative idea, then it almost always then creates feelings of exclusion, lack of voice, lack of recognition, and lack of safety. And I feel that these are concepts that we talk a lot about in the field of education. We talk about the whole student, creating a safe environment, respecting identities. But her point is that if the materials do not reflect that diversity and inclusivity, there's always that default back to that heteronormative view, which mm-hmm. can really shut students down.
Yeah. Can I jump in there and give you a little anecdote about a student completely shutting down in a heteronormative classroom? It was within a CELTA class, and the teachers were training on the CELTA course that I was a tutor on. And there was a lesson on marriage in the textbook. I don't even remember what book it was, but it was a mainstream course book. Mm. And the pictures were all of heterosexual couples getting married and wedding bells and a wedding reception and blah, blah, blah. And all of the students were completely engaged. I was watching this lesson as the teacher was very skillfully teaching it. All the students were very engaged, apart from one young man at the back of the class. And he didn't engage at all. He was silent throughout the class. I picked up that he was almost certainly of the LGBTQ community. Maybe it was my gaydar, but I had an intuition, and I couldn't confirm that, and it's not for me to confirm, but I did, in the feedback at the end of the lesson with the teachers, ask the teacher who was teaching, did you pick up on the fact that there was one student who wasn't engaged? And she didn't, she hadn't realized. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, why might that have been? And she just was clueless in the beginning. And I said, do you think it could have been that that student was not heterosexual and they didn't feel included in that class? And she was just gobsmacked. She was silent and she was so sorry. But that's what thousands, if not millions of teachers, that's the trap that they fall into, because they have the textbooks and they don't question them. And there's very little out there in terms of inclusivity in the course book. It could mm-hmm. have been very easily changed to accommodate that student.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's fantastic. And it's actually one of this author's main points of, you know, how can we make classrooms less heteronormative? And that's her number one point. She says, you know, really have a look at and question your personal and institutional biases and your prejudices. It's, I do think it's interesting that she attaches the words be brave to that. I liked that. I thought that was clever. It's true, because when you're challenging societal norms and when you're really having to look at yourself, I think there is a level of courage that has to go with that. Curiosity and openness, for sure, but definitely a bit of courage. And I also liked her term of what you're talking about is that teacher needing to make space for other views. And she says, re-queer straight-washed materials. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I thought that is interesting, that idea of straight washing materials, which I think it's like when you've been swimming in those waters for decades, you don't feel the water anymore, right? Sure. So it's I thought it was a very interesting way of talking about that. She also says things like, you know, becoming familiar with other terms, using they, using preferred pronouns, you know, switching to things like partner. Not correcting students when they say, you know, my husband or my wife, and they say, no, you're a man, so you must mean your wife. And then putting the student in the position of having to say, well, but he has a beard and he is a man, so he is my husband. Right.
Yeah, I think with these kind of tips that there are levels like of what you can do in those situations, right? As a teacher or as a writer or whoever. And you know, I think these are really good, because sometimes we have this idea that, you know, it's necessary to challenge this. It's necessary to go in with a whole kind of suite of new lessons, which may not be a bad thing, but realistically that may be difficult for some teachers to actually achieve. Mm-hmm. So just these kind of subtle alterations can be enough to at the very least avoid that situation which Christian just described. Mm-hmm. You're at least acknowledging
and in the
that
there
are other types of people,
right? And in the situation, all it would have needed was to have a greater range of pictures of people of all colors, able-bodied, disabled, and trans people, non-binary, and people of whatever sexuality. Just open that discussion about relationships and different kinds of commitments as well, because marriage is not across the board, and it assumes that everybody aspires to some kind of marriage ideal. That's all it would have taken to be brave enough to show some pictures, to brainstorm, and then open up the conversation and create a safe space where people could come forward and say, this is, you know, this is my reality.
I think that I'll challenge you a little bit on that idea of it being just that, because I, in my own personal experience, I have done things like that. I'm quite aware of incorporating ideas of inclusivity through pictures and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important for the teacher to appreciate that it can be a bit shocking for some students, that it can really push them out of their comfort zone, that they may be pushed back. That, so I do feel that there is a certain preparation a teacher might have in wanting to kind of skillfully navigate potential situations in the classroom. That's certainly been my experience. And I think that the what she calls the platinum rule applies here nicely too, because we talk about the golden rule, right? So treat others as you would like to be treated. But the author talks about the platinum rule, which is treat others as they wish to be treated. And I thought that was a very interesting spin on that, and kind of keeping that in mind can help navigate or even inform conversations that will come up in the classroom when teachers do start moving along these lines.
I think we have to acknowledge as well that the teaching context, the two of you are in particularly here, right, in Canada and in the United Kingdom, me to a slightly lesser extent here in Brazil, but compared to other places in the world, we have, as teachers, we have considerably more freedom to challenge this kind of status quo than a lot of teachers do, right? And so we have to acknowledge that while these things we're advocating for are still a little bit challenging in our contexts, in some other contexts, they are impossible, right? Mm-hmm. Even the teacher with the best will in the world simply can't do this. And you know, and there are shades of gray between those two points. And I think we just have to acknowledge the fact that, you know, it's not necessarily that easy to do these things for some people.
That is worth acknowledging. But at the same time, I live and teach in a city which is essentially one of the LGBTQ capitals of not only the UK, but the world, in Brighton. And the private language schools in Brighton are doing, as far as I understand, virtually nothing to open up the curriculum for diversity. And if it's not happening here, it's shameful. Yeah. How can it possibly happen in, for example, Hungary, in, for example, Poland, never mind Saudi Arabia or Qatar? It needs to start here in countries where it is possible. Yeah. And then eventually things will change in other places around the world too. So it takes a long time. It takes a long time, but it also takes energy and, as you say, bravery on the part of teachers, because institutions very rarely push for it. It's individual teachers within institutions. And there is one school in Brighton where a friend of mine has really looked to diversify the curriculum He happens to be Black and happens to be pansexual and has really done a lot of work to diversify the curriculum. But the other schools that I know of have done nothing, absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I included recently in my teacher training program a focus specifically. I had Tyson actually come in and do a workshop on, you know, heteronormativity and adapting materials and things like that. And the feedback I got from my trainees, my student teachers, was some polar opposites. So I had some very strong pushback from some students who were accusing me of brainwashing them by inviting Tyson to come in and do the talk. And yet I had other students, it gives me a little bit of chills. The feedback was, I've finally been seen. I can't tell you how inspired and motivated and excited I am to continue in my career knowing that this is an avenue I can start to explore in my own teaching. And I thought, wow, like it was fascinating and obviously worth it.
I also think that kickback, that pushback is part of the learning and a sign that barriers are beginning to crumble when people start to assess. And that anger and pushback is the first shift that's necessary sometimes. It's a little bit like when, you know this, Tanya, I think, but when you give a very reticent and defensive teacher some feedback and you know that they're dying to shout, oh, just shut up. And they're trying to take it on board, but they're looking angry. And whatever you do to soften it, they get angry. And it's because there's dissonance going on there. And then I think that's the first really valuable sign.
I agree. And I wondered about the level of vitriol as well. I was curious about the level of anger from some of my students. And I almost felt like because I had established such a great atmosphere of trust and respect and collegiality, I felt like they thought that suddenly I had done something to transgress that. And which I thought was very interesting. So I think you're right. I think it was a burst. And I do wonder, considering the positive impact as well, the positive feedback, that maybe there's a little more pause for thought. And the next time that they attend a workshop on inclusivity and diversity, you know, there may be a little bit more openness there. So let's move on to the next article now. Christian, can you tell us which one you read?
Well, it links very much into your theme. I read an article by Silvana Paolo Accardo on queering the curricula at teacher training education, which is exactly what you were talking about. And interestingly, she's Argentinian. She was talking about the National Comprehensive Sexuality Education Program, the CSE, it's abbreviated, in Argentina. So it was made compulsory basically at all levels of education in Argentina from 2006 to teach about sexuality and diversity. It advocates for diversity, equal representation, and human rights to be included at all levels, as I said, of the education system.
Sorry, Christian, are they talking about the public school system? Are they talking about the private system?
They're talking, as far as I understand, about across the board, public and private. Mm-hmm. And there is also curriculum guidance. And she says, interestingly, this hasn't been done for EFL. So essentially, the article was about how they did that. They brainstormed ideas, how to work it within to the curriculum in EFL, and created a Padlet for shared ideas. So it was basically a call for action and to integrate it into the curriculum in somewhere like Argentina, where it's been made mandatory. In the UK, interestingly, we have kind of an equivalent. It's called PSHE Education, Personal, Social, Health, and Economic Education. And this is at primary and secondary and tertiary level as well, actually. It's mandatory for teachers to teach about relationships at primary education and relationships and sexuality and sex at secondary education. There's been a lot of debate about this. In fact, in Birmingham in 2019, it was all over the media where particularly Muslim parents were protesting outside schools, saying, "You're brainwashing my children." And the government, to some extent, backed down and said this needed to be a negotiation with parents. But yeah, it is happening in this country, in the UK as well. But but the government has fudged it somewhat.
Well, it's interesting because there is a crossover in our articles. And one of the aspects that my article talks about is trying to avoid tokenism. Does your article talk about tokenism?
It doesn't talk about that specifically, no, but it talks very much about getting to grassroots level of the curriculum and making it count. But I think there is a danger of tokenism. For example, I was talking to a primary school teacher here about how they include sexuality and diversity within the curriculum. And he said, "Oh, yes, we had a great week where we could choose our own storybooks for the children." And I've been doing some research. There's some wonderful storybooks out there about, you know, about two dads or two moms. Or, for example, there's one called Mommy, Mama and Me, about a lesbian couple bringing up a child, and King and King, which is about a prince, and the queen wants him to marry a princess, and basically he goes through all the princesses and not interested, not interested, not interested, and finally meets a prince and they get married and the queen is happy. But these kind of storybooks were being used in a friend of mine's classroom, and apparently it was received really well by the children. They were fascinated. But maybe that could be accused of being tokenism, for example.
Is that tokenism because it's like a special week?
Exactly. Exactly.
And what we want is not to have a special week, but this to just be mainstream.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right? For it to be normalized, essentially.
Yes. That was the word I was just going to say as well. I would say the opposite is just normalizing it. It's not.
I mean, I would say that if this is a first step, then okay, but it can't be the only step.
Exactly.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Like it becomes a tick box thing. Like, no, we had a week. Well, in fact, in many ways, if you have a special week, then you're kind of making it separate, right?
Exactly.
You're kind of reinforcing the mainstream heteronormative ideas again, right?
Yes. Exactly. And there is another point that she makes in my article, which I think has crossover to yours, Christian, and also is connected to tokenism, is that if you do bring in, or when you do bring in these ideas, focusing on queer identities or queer experience, to not treat it as a subject of debate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it needs to be more of an organic conversation, and that bringing in, like having a debating topic of, you know, should lesbian couples be allowed to adopt, or should gay couples, it's not conducive to building bridges of understanding between different communities.
Completely. I think what this friend of mine did at primary school was still valuable, as James said. It's the first step. Bring in a quote from this article by Silvana Accardo. She says, "What is not named does not exist. What is not named has no rights. What is not named is not seen or respected. It is left aside, left alone, and marginalized. Being named is one of the first steps in constructing our own identity and subjectivity. It's how we're presented to the world." And I suppose it is useful as a first step. And then after that, yeah, it needs to be normalized and totally integrated into the curriculum. You know, we still have Black History Month in this country.
We do
you
too.
Know, great in and of itself. But if race is not integrated into the curriculum, then, you know, it's still tokenism. Mm.
And that leads us to your article. Is that right, James? Which article did you choose?
Well, before we move on, I was just going to mention to anyone who's interested in Silvana's article, apart from reading, obviously, to take a look at the group that she has on Facebook and Instagram called Hello ESI. Mm-hmm. You do a search for that and you'll see that they do a lot of activism in Argentina related to the subject. And they're quite inspiring people, let me tell you.
So wonderful.
I recommend. Yeah.
Thank you.
And also in the last episode of DevelopPod, actually, Victoria spoke a little bit more about this law in Argentina. So you might want to skip back to our previous episode and listen to Victoria. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, James, what did you read about?
So I read the article Representation of Black People in Teaching Materials by Amanda Hawthorne. And I think the title really, you know, sums that up there for you very, very neatly. I mean, and so Amanda's analysis is excellent, very interesting. It's short and it gets straight to the point, which is sometimes very valuable. Yeah, as a materials writer, I found it very interesting and very, very useful. But it's not just for materials writers. There's also points for teachers as well. So the article that she's looking at, how are Black people visually represented in this material that was being used with upper intermediate young learners in a particular school, right? So it's a very specific area. And then there's a subsidiary question, which is, does the visual representation of Black people change when juxtaposed in an image with white people? So what she's doing here is looking at this through the lens of critical race theory, particularly the critical discourse analysis related to images. So that's a very interesting perspective, right? And it's a very intelligent way to look at this particular issue, I think, to look at the visual representation. And I think there's lots of really interesting points that she raises. One thing, and we'll go back to something you said earlier, Tanya, which is the idea that she also mentions that education is not neutral. These choices are not neutral. And this quote that she said, which I thought was particularly excellent, which is to say, her perspective sees racism as bound into all parts of society and institutions as a normal everyday occurrence. Right? That's critical race theory, which means that editing materials to avoid parsnips can be viewed as far from neutral. Another perspective might be that parsnips is another way of binding racism into teaching materials.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if you have any reaction to that.
I do, certainly from a teacher trainer's perspective, because there's often this big push of, we don't use the parsnips topics, they're too controversial, that's not our role. I feel like that's, I don't know, like almost like willful ignorance. Like, what do you mean? It's not our role. Like, we're dealing with the holistic person. We're not teaching in a vacuum. We're not
Also, we're sort of separating ourselves from the role of being an educator in general, right? So we're sort of saying, as language teachers, that is a sort of special thing that doesn't have any particular qualities that signifies as a teacher, you know. So I think there are things that teachers do irrespective of the subjects that they teach, and I think this idea that we occupy this kind of strange land where kind of nothing interesting ever happens is quite odd, because for two reasons. One, you know, our subject is one of the subjects which is kind of the most basic in terms of, it's like part of human communication. You know, it's like a very basic human need, right? The need to be able to speak and communicate.
Yes, to have a voice.
But then also the fact that in communicative language teaching, which is what most teachers who are listening to us will be doing, personalization is a huge part of that. We're always asking our students, what do you think? Well, you know, what's your opinion about this? Like, people didn't do that in the past, but they do that now.
Yes.
But then the idea that we're going to make this very personal, but hold on, there's a whole area of stuff. We don't want to deal with that. Just this personal. I find a huge contradiction there.
For our listeners who don't know what parsnips are, can we just review that acronym?
Sure. Yes.
Remember, between us, P stands for politics.
Politics.
Right?
Politics.
Yeah. A stands for
alcohol.
R stands for
religion.
S stands for
sex.
N.
Narcotics.
Yeah. And I.
Isms,
yeah, like racism, for example. Yeah,
exactly.
Couldn't be discussed. And P, interestingly,
is pork.
Pork, yes. That's really random at the end.
It is.
It represents, doesn't it, cultural?
Yeah,
cultural representations that are not acceptable in some cultures.
Why not beef? Why not parsnip? You know,
because that's not a word.
But beef isn't acceptable in many parts of India. So, I mean, anyway, you know, my point.
Parsnip is not a thing. She mentions, when it comes to parsnip, she mentions the fact that kind of, you know, like talking about race and racism is sort of relegated to like being a sub part of one of these letters of this acronym. you know, mm-hmm. doesn't even get its own letter.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah, funny, sad, funny. Yes.
So basically we're being political by the very fact that we're trying to depoliticize the classroom, which is never possible in the first place. That's
in essence
what you're saying. I mean, 30 years ago when I did my teacher training, that was thrown at us. We were indoctrinated into, an English teacher and nothing else. You have to steer clear of anything else which is controversial. And now it's come, at least in some countries where it's safer to do this, mm-hmm. in our countries, I think we can assume that it's not only our role, but our duty to bring mm-hmm. these discussions into the classroom.
Mm-hmm. I'm lucky in the sense that, you know, I live and work in the country of Paulo Freire, right? So it means that the vast majority of teachers here will have been educated with the knowledge of Paulo Freire's work. And one of those central basic premises of his idea is, you know, there is no such thing as neutrality. You're either supporting the oppressed or the oppressor. And, you know, that's the things that mm-hmm. we've been talking about. That's mm-hmm. what it is, right? It's like there mm-hmm. is no neutral position. It does mm-hmm. not exist. Mm-hmm. And I think if you accept that position, then you either have to say, okay, I'm going to try and do something here to be on the side of the oppressed, or I'm playing a role in supporting this, whether it's heteronormativity or racism or whatever it is, right? That is siding with the oppressor. And that's the role mm-hmm. that I've chosen to take, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that's obviously puts people in an uncomfortable position. There are people like, I think, the teachers that you're working with, Tanya, they would reject that notion, right, of neutrality not existing. But I don't think that stands up to very much analysis at all. I think it's very easy once you start to, you mm-hmm. know, if you know how to do sort of breaking down images on a critical level, for example.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be wise really to, you know, to move into a new arena of teacher training where, of course, you can still introduce new teachers to the concept of Parsnip, and that historically and even currently, these are topics that are supposedly best avoided. But I think it needs to be taken one step further, that challenge that concept. Do they need to be avoided? And if you don't want to avoid them, learn how to incorporate it into your classroom skillfully.
Hmm. Yeah, so you may not be able to change the course book that you use in your classroom,
yes,
but you are able to engage students in a dialogue where you question what is contained within it. Yeah,
exactly.
Can I mention some of Amanda's, because Amanda's article is very practical. I wanted to mention some of the recommendations. So for teachers, she recommends mandatory training for teaching staff and how to talk about race and racism to students.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then another recommendation is for the mandatory teaching of visual literacy for students to include how race is commonly depicted visually. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is, this would just be useful for students anyway, to be honest. No, you know, not just with racism, but with other mm-hmm. other subjects. I think that mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. visual literacy, as Amanda mentions, is often something that people are very bad at. And they really don't know how to discuss and break down what it is that they're looking at and how it represents power mm-hmm.
And what metaphors are being promoted. And there's a lot. I completely agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she has a lot of recommendations for materials, designers, writers and publishers,
mm-hmm.
Which include things like the specific inclusion of images of Black people in positions of power when in a group of non-Black people. So what her analysis really showed, I should mention, is the fact that Black people were portrayed in 22% of all images. But the question she was asking was not just what are Black people shown doing, but what are they not shown doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what activities are absent from the images, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the times that a Black person was represented as active and not dominated by a white person was only in 10% of the images in the material.
Interesting.
So I think this is really interesting because of the fact that I think in comparison with when we talk about sexuality, I think that most people would agree that if you compare teaching materials from, you know, the decades, some sort of representative material from the 60s up to today as a representative of that decade, you would see an improvement in how people of color have been represented, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, I think if you did the same analysis with LGBT people, then you wouldn't find the same. You would find it mm-hmm. basically barely improved, if anything at all. because mm-hmm. there has been some kind of improvement, I think that they can make us complacent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what mm-hmm. I think Amanda is doing here is reminding us that actually
there's still a way to go.
There's still a way to go. And just having a picture of a person of color there is not enough. Mm-hmm. And you have to think about what is that picture?
Mm-hmm.
What is it doing? And how is that person interacting mm-hmm. with the other people?
Definitely. It kind of makes me think of one of the statements from Elizabeth Coleman's article as well, that ultimately, as teachers, we're always trying to meet our learners where they are. And she says, and for some, it's a very queer place is where your learners are. It's a very specific place. So how can you meet them there if you deny the existence of their place in the first place?
Mm. And another quote maybe fits in with that from Silvana. It's of paramount importance to provide future teachers with the resources and strategies to cater for all identities. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're spotting some themes here, aren't we? Yeah. Where you can see that we've got mm-hmm, these themes mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. this idea of neutrality being a myth.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've got this idea that training and mm-hmm. Training for teachers and for writers and for students is very important.
And needs updating.
Yeah. Are there any other themes you think we've spotted here?
I think that idea of, you know, raising awareness and becoming aware of your own as a teacher, staying open and curious, and the idea of being brave and continuing to challenge your own prejudices, your institutional's prejudices, your students' prejudices, and keep the conversations going, I think is also a common thread between the three.
But I think it also comes down to government legislation as well for it to move forwards. And I think the shift in Argentina has really shown me that it's been a bit half-hearted in the UK, quite frankly, from the government. You know, there's been protests and mm-hmm. pushback, and they've said, oh, well, in negotiation with parents, as mm-hmm. opposed to laying down absolutely what needs to be done.
I agree. And in Canada, it's very much about indigenizing the curriculum. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, Elizabeth Coleman talks about intersectionality and that needs to be taken into consideration, that ultimately it's the whole umbrella of inclusivity, as opposed to just, okay, so now we're going to ensure that, you know, we have people of color, and then, oh, now we're going to ensure that we have our Indigenous population represented. And I feel it's a bit more of like how UDL, you know, Universal Design Learning, is kind of taking that more of that umbrella approach. And it's about all inclusivity.
Okay, it's a good place to wind up, I think. We've had a really intelligent conversation today. I think you'd agree, guys, which is not like us.
I know. What happened?
And where can our listeners find all of these articles? I believe we're allowing open access to everyone, including mm-hmm. people who are not TDSIG members.
TDSIG members. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll provide the link in the show notes for mm-hmm. this volume 2 of the TDAJ. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if people want to have a look for themselves, they can just go to the website, right? TDSIG.org. So this issue of TDAJ was themed around the Web Carnival that we did. So this is just a reminder that the next Web Carnival will be coming up in February. Take a look at our social media to find out more, and on our website, there's a Web Carnival page. So the theme of the event will be critical pedagogy and Paulo Freire's influence on ELT, as I did mention Paulo Freire earlier. So there's a link. Just go to our website again, tdsig.org, and look for the Web Carnival in the menu. Thanks for listening, everyone. Remember, if you want to stay in touch with TDSIG, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just do a search for TDSIG. And you can, of course, as I mentioned several times, have a look at our website, because everything is there, tdsig.org. And you can subscribe to this podcast in all the podcast places, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Yeah, should we wrap things up?
Let's wrap this thing up.
I think that's about it.
Stay warm if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. Keep slapping that suntan lotion on if you're in the Southern. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Bye for now. Bye. Take care.
Bye-bye.